It is critical you pay attention at this time. The following program is being broadcast to all fans of Nova and for the preservation of the Zandarian homeworld's culture. I am the world mind and I am turning control over to my human host.
Welcome to a new episode of Xandar Radio. I'm Doug Smith, also known online as Nova64, and I run the Nova Prime page at novaprimepage.com. In this latest episode, there's a bit of everything this time. The news section has an update from Diamond Select Toys on their Nova statue. The Cupid section features an archived interview with Sal Buscema, the artist on The Man Called Nova. The Learn More in Studio 64 segment has a new creator interview with Annihilation and Nova artist Andrea DeVito. And to wrap up the episode, the serialized Nova radio drama, Super Adventures, has the second part of the Sands of Time story. So I'll get started and I'd like to thank you for listening and following the show. If this is your first time listening, welcome. I hope you enjoy it and will become one of the champions of Xandar Radio, which simply means following or subscribing to the podcast on your preferred platform. I do want to apologize for missing the month of February in terms of releasing a new episode. I came down with COVID early in the month, followed by a sinus infection. Between the two, it simply slowed things down to the point that February was going to be missed. Thankfully, I am vaccinated and boosted, so it was not as bad as it could have been. So again, I am sorry for the delay, but I hope you'll find it worth the wait. Moving on to comics, despite being on the cover of February's Captain Marvel number 36, Rich Rider Nova was not seen in the actual comic, which I always find extremely irritating. If a character is on the standard cover, then the inferred idea is that the character will be in the book. I completely understand it if it's a variant cover, as those rarely reference the comic's contents. However, the standard cover should have the character shown on them and not be a bait and switch. It's now time again for Nova Trivia. I'll ask a question and give the answer at the end of the program. This month's question is, Rich Rider Nova's enemy, Mega Man, had a connection to the hero beyond the standard hero-villain relationship. What was it? Let's go to the Nova Newsroom for updates on the human rocket.
The Nova Newsroom.
Let's begin the news with an update on the Nova statue coming soon from Diamond Select Toys. Here with the update is Zach Oat, Marketing Supervisor from DST.
Hey guys, it's Zach Oat from Diamond Select Toys. Just wanted to check in and let you know that the Nova PVC diorama is coming. We're expecting it in late spring, early summer, and hopefully you guys can hold on just a little while longer because it's a really great piece. Enjoy the rest of the show.
Thanks, Zach. Over at Upper Deck, the card company has released a hybrid digital and physical Nova card in their Marvel Unbound set. The art is by Fred Ian, and it was available first as a digital card. However, an owner of the digital card has the option to trade that card in for a physical version of the card. Speaking of digital cards, let's take a look at Topps' latest Nova digital cards in its Marvel Collect app. Rich Rider Nova appears on two of the Adventures of Spider-Woman set, two cards of the Topps Now set, represents the letter N in the alphabet set, and is on one of the Editor's Choice cards. The Nova Corps appears on two cards of the Homage cover set, while Sam Alexander Nova appears on two of the same set. Sam is also on three of the Battle set. As always, if you're interested, images of the items mentioned in this news segment can be found at novaprimepage.com. Coming up is a Cupid segment featuring an archived interview with the artist on The Man Called Nova, Sal Buscema. Cupids feature shorter interviews with creators that would normally be in the Studio 64 segment. As for the segment name, Cupids is short for Question Bits. It's also a homage to the synth-organic Nova Corps member named Cupid from the Abnett Lanning Nova series. This installment is an interview with Sal Buscema, who was one of the artists on the original Man Called Nova series in the 1970s. A little background on this. It is part of an interview I conducted back in 2007 as part of the research for a Nova article I was writing for Tomorrow's Back Issue magazine. Due to Mr. Buscema's lack of email at the time, it was done over the telephone. Also, please keep in mind that digital technology wasn't what it is today, so what you are hearing is a phone call recorded on cassette tape and then digitized. So hang in there, and I hope you'll find the contents interesting.
How did the assignment for Nova come about?
Oh my gosh. You've stumped me already, Doug. I honestly don't remember. My best recollection is that I think my brother did the first issue. I'm really not sure about that, and either he didn't want to do it anymore, or he didn't have enough time to do it, and anyway, that's how I got it.
Okay.
Period.
The next one is, how did you feel about Nova as a character and working on the series in general with Marv Wolfman?
Well, yeah, Marv's a good writer. And I enjoyed working with him. As far as the character was concerned, I thought it was a good character. I didn't think it was a terribly unique character. But, you know, it's very difficult to characterize this because I've worked on so many of the Marvel characters. And it's kind of difficult to say, well, you know, this one was better than that one was better than this one. It's just kind of, I know this is a kind of a rambling answer, but it's so long ago. I mean, we're talking about over 30 years ago. I honestly don't have any great recollection of, you know, exactly how I felt about it. I know I enjoyed working with Marv. I always enjoyed working with him, and the character was fine, so.
Just one more here.
Go ahead.
This has to do with the number 5 issue, and that's the one where you and Marv basically had Nova come to Marvel Comics to
try and make a comic. Remember, right.
Okay,
right.
And I just wanted to know if, you know, how much fun was that to work on? And
oh, that was a lot of fun. That was a lot of fun. I think Marv kind of made me appear as a kind of an idiot, but that was part of the fun of the thing. It was fun to write. I mean, to draw or interpret his writing and put that in picture form. I do remember that very specifically, and I can't remember exactly what the line was, but I think Marv told me something like, just shut up and let's go, Sal, or something like that. And I remember being a little indignant about that. But, that was just a fun job.
Okay. Well, that was it, Mr. Buscema. I appreciate your time.
Coming up in the Learn More in Studio 64 segment is a new creator interview with Annihilation and Nova artist Andrea DeVito.
Learn More in Studio 64.
Welcome to a new Learn More in Studio 64 segment. It's a real privilege to welcome Andrea DeVito to the show. Andrea is joining us from his beautiful home country of Italy today. I honestly wish this interview was being done in person because it's a beautiful country from what I hear. Andrea was the artist on Annihilation and the Abnett and Lanning Nova series. He is also the only comic creator I know who shares the same birthday as me. So welcome to the program, Andrea.
Thank you very much, Doug. Thank you very much. It's a pleasure and an honor to be here.
Oh, thank you. You know, being from Italy, what was your first exposure to comics and what led you to be an artist?
Well, my first exposure was what we had when I was little here in Italy. We used to read Mickey Mouse comic books, you know, Carl Barks and those kind of stories. And those were very interesting to me, but the real infatuation and love with comics came after when I read John Buscema's Savage Sword of Conan. That was actually a real turning point in my life. I became obsessed with comics as an art form, and I started reading everything that I could find. developing my tastes and everything. So I focused on American comics the most because those were the ones that resonated with me more. John has been probably the biggest influence in my work.
I seem to recall you had met him at one point. Is that right?
Yes. Yes. It was a beautiful day that we spent together when it was here in Rome for a convention. And I was lucky enough to, since I spoke English a little bit, I was able to have a conversation with him. Then we went to dinner, and it was probably one of the most crazy days of my life, being able to talk to an idol of mine and just pick his brain about his career and what he liked and what he didn't like. And he was just an amazing person. Other than an amazing artist, he was just personally a beautiful person.
Wow. That's, I like to always hear that artists are nice to other people. Now, being an Italian working on American comics, when you were starting, did you find any sort of language or cultural obstacles that you had to overcome when you started?
Not so much, a little bit, but thanks to the fact that I was used to reading American comic books, and I actually learned English through comics on my own. Oh. I never went to a school or anything, so it was easier for me when I got to the point where I actually started working with the United States and, in the American comic market. It was easier for me to adapt, and I found it very refreshing compared to what we deal with here in Italy. Scripts, comic book scripts here in Italy are very strict. You don't have any leeway when it comes to adapting it to the drawing form. You cannot change anything that is written on the script. While in America, I found more freedom. I was actually encouraged to put my own vision on things. Nothing major, mind you, but I was allowed to have more fun in the creative process.
Oh, that's great. Do you recall how you got your first assignment in American comics?
Yes, it was actually at the San Diego Comic-Con. I went there with all the savings that I could muster, and I was looking for work. And I remember standing in line, and I was doing, all the comic book reviews, all the lines for Marvel and DC, Image, Dark Horse. And I remember I was in line, and I started talking to the guy in front of me, because we basically did all the lines together. And the guy was Steve McNiven. So we actually became friends. And after the convention, I actually met Mark Alessi, that at the time was putting together the CrossGen company, CrossGen Comics. And he hired me as an intern because he liked my work. And when I had to relocate to the United States, because CrossGen was hiring me as an apprentice, basically, I went there and I found Steve McNiven was hired as well. So we were both the apprentices in the company. And it was such a funny feeling just to see his face again.
There he was. Uh-huh.
But yeah, CrossGen Comics was my big break.
Oh, yeah. I know some creators had to move to Florida. Is that right?
Yes. Oh. Yes, yes. I had to relocate as well from Rome, Italy, to Florida.
I remember first seeing your work on The Thing, and that was just wonderful. What a wonderful series.
Thank you.
And soon after that, I think that's Annihilation came along.
Yes.
Now, I seemed to, when I talked to Andy Schmidt, it seemed like it took him a while to get Annihilation approved and moved forward because Cosmic Comics at that time weren't as popular as they are now.
Yes.
Do you recall when you were brought into the creative team?
Oh, absolutely. I was working on The Thing at the time. I think I was working on issue 5 or something like that. And Tom Brevoort, who was the editor on that book, told me, we are closing down The Thing with issue 8 because it's not selling so well. but we would like to for you to move on to this other project that we have. And I'm like, okay, you know, I would like to finish working on the thing first, because in my mind, you know, I'm so attached to that character that I wanted to finish the entire book. But he said, no, 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 you don't understand. You know, you need to move on to the other book because, you know, that's starting and it's going to be good for your career. So I was very naive at the time. But anyway, I got in touch with Andy Schmidt and he talked to me about Annihilation. And I soon realized that it was going to be a lot of work, like this huge, giant, sprawling epic. And I was always a fan of the cosmic side of Marvel. One of my favorite heroes of all time is Warlock. I was in love with Jim Starlin's work with Captain Marvel and Warlock. So I was already interested. Plus the idea of resurrecting an entire corner of the Marvel universe was very appealing. I mean, that part of Marvel hadn't been used in years in a major way. So it was a very important thing for me. What Andy told me is that we would be in a very peculiar position with that saga because it was being published at the same time as Civil War. Civil War was this huge Marvel event that they had in the summer with the superheroes fighting against one another. And my buddy, Steve McNiven, was drawing it. But he told me soon that basically all the attention would have been on Civil War. So we could have concentrated on doing something almost under the radar. And that's why we have been able to have so much creative freedom on Annihilation. Because, frankly, from what I was told, Marvel didn't believe a lot in the effect that Annihilation would have. So it was almost like, okay, let's have these guys play, you know, in this corner of the universe. Let's see what they can come up with. And they didn't expect it to be so well received. So I remember that Andy was almost feeling like he had a little bit of a revenge, you know, after so much work and organizing the entire event to just see it do so well sales-wise.
And it, you know, I'm sure it probably in some ways was kind of liberating in that nobody is watching over your shoulder with all these huge expectations that you can kind of just, you know, do as, you know, very freeing as from a creative standpoint.
Absolutely.
And you were working with Keith Giffen, who's also just a wonderful writer and artist. His approach to writing scripts, since he is also an artist, did you find that different than someone who, say, is strictly a writer?
Yes, yes, absolutely. The thing that sets it apart is that when you're drawing something that has been written by someone that can draw, and in Keith Gibson's case, I mean, the guy is a legend in the field. He's really, really good. What I found is that we started communicating more on images than text. He needed to give me very little input when it comes to describing scenes. He let me go on many, many steps of the way because he knew that we would be seeing the same thing, basically. He referred to movies or songs for particular feelings and stuff. So one thing that was very interesting to me was that he basically, when he described something, he would just use images. So I would actually see it in my head. Instead of coming up with a vision for the thing, he was able to evoke an image in my head when I was reading his scripts. And soon after the second issue, I think, we started working with plots, the old Marvel way. So he would actually give me a plot instead of a script so that he could concentrate on dialogues. And he would just describe the scenes very briefly because he would know that I could be trusted with the storytelling part of the job. And it was a very powerful feeling for me to be entrusted with so much responsibility, but at the same time to be trusted so much, you know?
Oh, and it's well justified. It's just a beautiful, beautiful piece of work.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
I know all us Nova fans, we just, it was such a character altering series that I know, and I have read comics for so long that it takes a lot to, you know, make my jaw drop, but I was scraping my jaw off the tile quite a bit. It was just a wonderful piece of work.
Thank you.
As you were talking, that Keith would give you, say, movie or references to things. When you're building, you're doing world building, mm-hmm. and creating technology for science fiction, how does your mind... I'm always fascinated by the creative process. So I'm always wondering how someone goes about doing that. Do you look at common objects and decide to flip it on its head? Or I don't know. I just find it fascinating.
Well, in Annihilation's case, for example, it was a process like what you described, you know, looking at everyday objects and turning them into spaceships or buildings or what have you. That works, but until a certain point, I had to realize sooner than later that Annihilation was such a big, big project. I mean, we're talking about scenes that required me to draw thousands of spaceships. I mean, I didn't have any 3D computer help at that time. Everything that you see came out of my hand. So I needed to be able to create something that I could replicate with ease. I don't want to say that it was easy, but shapes that I would be comfortable with when it came to the time of doing mass scenes of battle and, huge invasions in this case. So I had to look at shapes that I would be comfortable handling in perspective. For other stuff, like costumes or things like that, I always try to keep things asymmetric. Because I remember when I was still an apprentice at CrossGen, Bart Sears told me one day that one thing that makes a design work most of the time is when you keep things not in a symmetric value, but when you shift your symmetry and have things have a different shape that is not perfectly balanced, that becomes a point of interest. So I kept that in mind. And for other things, I really tried to keep it as simple as I could, because I knew that I would have to draw it thousands of times.
Yeah, that's I can understand that. Oh, and you know, later on, you joined the regular Nova series with Abnett and Lanning.
Yes.
Having talked to Dan Abnett, I didn't realize he had an art background. He went to be an artist and decided to become a writer. And then, of course, Andy Lanning, who's also an artist. How was working with them different than, say, Keith Giffen?
Ah, completely different. I love both of those guys. I mean, they produced so much quality work for one of my favorite heroes, because, you know, I'm a Nova fanboy as well. So I was very happy when I knew that I could work with them, because I already knew what they were doing. The main difference is that when I worked on Nova, I suddenly had the chance of seeing the character unfold. When I worked on Annihilation, everything was very packed, very busy. We had a huge cast of characters. And yes, Richard had that role of the leader, basically, of the resistance against Annihilus. But except for a few glances, we never had a chance to really get into his head as a character. When I worked on Nova, what Abnett and Lanning did was enrich Richard, sorry for the pun, not intended, and I was able to finally know my hero better. So in a working way, what they did was give me scripts that were more deep, in a sense, so that I could work better on facial expressions and how the characters would act compared to one another. It was a deeper journey compared to Annihilation. Annihilation was it was the Lord of the Rings, if you want, and Nova was more of a Hobbit. It was more of an intimate journey compared to, you know, the big action that was Annihilation. Not that Nova didn't have any action, because we had plenty, but I found that it being able to focus more on the character's journey gave me something more to work with when it came to the art.
Oh, and on a personal note, yeah, you included the Nova Prime page in one of the issues, and yeah, you guys caught me off guard with that one. I had no idea that was coming. And, my wife's going, "Why are you freaking out?" I'm like, "I'm going to show you. Let me show you." So I just wanted to publicly say thank you so much for that.
You are very welcome. It was a real pleasure to do that.
And, you know, we were talking earlier about having to hand draw a lot of the ships in Annihilation and such, whereas now with the computers, you can digitally just recreate those. And I know like Brian Denham, who did some issues of Nova, he works strictly digital. Do you find that are you using the digital format now, or are you still the traditional, or some kind of mix of those?
For me, it depends on the project that I'm doing. I've been using the digital medium more and more these days, simply because it opens up a lot of possibilities when it comes to tools. For example, if you look at what Pepe Larraz is doing, or Larraz, I don't know his name, he's doing on the X-Men. He's working a lot of with gray tones and things that would require you a lot of time if you did them in the traditional way, and would not be 100% printable in that with those kind of nuances. The digital world offers a lot more possibilities, but at the same time, I found that it's also full of little traps, in the sense that tools are what they are. And unless they are given a personal touch, there's a risk that one or more artists can end up looking the same way. What I do usually, I stick to the traditional medium for most of my work. When it comes to tight deadlines, I use more the digital medium because it's faster and allows me to change things on the fly. So if I see, or if I have an idea that works better on the page, I can get in at any stage and make a change. That is a huge plus in my field. While before, we had to do patches, you know, with paper on paper, and it was never a good result. And it always took a lot of work to make it functional. For many things, I think that the traditional way of working still offers advantages, because it tends to be more appreciated by the public, that's for sure. And the second thing is that it leaves you with something tangible at the end of the day that you have produced, that you have made. The digital, on the other hand, offers you speed and a lot more tools, offers you more options to express your talents in a fast way.
I have always kind of wondered, as an artist who trained for all your years in the traditional methods, going to digital, did you have to train your hands differently? Is there a kind of pressure feedback to your hands that's different?
Yes, there is a learning curve. It's actually very fast, if I thought about it. I mean, if I think about the past, it took me maybe, I don't know, a month to get adjusted to the digital way. The most jarring sensation, most jarring feeling that you get is being deprived of the attrition that you have between pencil and paper. That's something that is not being replicated yet. And it seems weird to say it, but there is skill in that as well. how you use the pencil, the way you tilt it, the way it fights against the paper sometimes can bring you to other effects. Mm-hmm. I don't know how to describe this with words, but yes, there is a difference. There is a big difference. At the start, I felt like I was working on glass, basically, like I was using a marker on a piece of glass. But after a while, you get adjusted to it. The big problem that I see with the digital world, and I have to be honest, when I mean, I use it all the time. I'm working on it with it right now, but I'm seeing a lot of options. Like it allows you to work with pencils and inks and washes and what have you, watercolors on the fly. The main issue that I see is that the tools that are at your disposal are not so personal. You know what I mean? Like if I use watercolor in the real world, I'm going to use it in a way that is going to be different from somebody else in the amount of water that I use and the kind of brush that I use on the paper that I use. So when you do it in the digital world, my watercolor, it's going to look very close to somebody else's watercolor that uses the same program. You know what I mean?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yes. So that's my main fear when I see people diving into the digital world, is that there is no clear separation when it comes to style. There are differences, but you can see traces of the software in one artist and another. And the other thing that I don't like is that it makes it too easy for those that don't have the necessary skills or knowledge to fake them.
Mm-hmm.
So you can trace 3D models, you can trace pictures, you can trace a lot of things that you are not able to draw. I'm not talking about, you know, the big artists that are using the digital medium, but a lot of newcomers are taking shortcuts thanks to the digital world. And I'm not very sure that it's the right thing to do right now, you know, especially when you're learning a new skill set for a job.
You actually explained it so much better than I asked it. So thank you. But yeah, I completely understand what you mean, that it does. It feels like it is. It's like glass. That was an excellent example. And, you know, the fact that you live in Italy that just has so much cultural history in terms of the arts, just wonderful. Are there other forms of art that you like to do, say, commercially or just personally, given that you're surrounded by so much art?
Yes. Well, I got into painting a few years ago, but it's more like on a, you know, a guilty pleasure of mine. I don't do it for business. I use it for commissions when it comes to fans that want a particular piece colored or painted. I try my hand at it. I'm still learning how to do it. I'm absolutely not a professional painter or anything like that, but I love to explore the world of the arts. I would love to sculpt one day, but it requires a lot of time. And, you know, right now between comic books and children and everything else, I really can't see myself sculpting in any way or form. But it's something that I would love to try my hand to one day.
Also wanted to ask, what current projects are you working on that we can look forward to?
Oh, okay. I'm just finishing up. I'm working on the last issue of Wolverine Patch miniseries set in the 90s. And it's based on the time when Logan was in Madripoor under the identity of Patch, the one-eyed owner of the Princess Bar. And the great thing is that I'm working with the legendary script writer Larry Hama. That did an amazing run on Wolverine in the 90s. And we're basically picking up the story where he left it off. So it's really amazing. And it's a great story. So I'm having a lot of fun doing that. And the other thing is that, it hasn't been announced yet, but I will be doing a reunion with my old buddy, Dan Slott, and I'm going to be working on Fantastic Four for a few issues. So that's something that I really look forward to.
Yeah, it's not a video. It's not a video call, but I'm like I'm quietly clapping my hands. So, so that's great to hear. I'll be picking that up.
Yes, yes. I think I'll do two or three issues. I'm not sure yet, but as soon as they told me, I was like, man, this is going to be fun.
You know, those just sound fantastic. And I want to encourage everyone listening today to pick up a copy of any work that Andrea has done and is doing currently. So thank you again so much, Andrea, for being on the show today.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure and a lot of fun.
In the tradition of classic Golden Age radio serials, Super Adventures brings you stories from the full tapestry of the Nova Universe. From the peak of Xandarian civilization to the far future of the Nova Corps, along with stories of characters new and old, Xandar Radio is proud to present Super Adventures.
Our story, Sands of Time, continues. In the last episode, we witnessed the powerful being known as the Sphinx encounter a very immense energy storm in the time stream. The Sphinx, a combined form consisting of the immortal male Sphinx and his eternal partner Lady Sphinx, discover the storm is actually a destructive Mobius strip. The strip was created by the actions of Galactus and threatens the entire space-time continuum. The Sphinx is horrified to find the strip itself consists of an endless number of duplicating bodies of the male Sphinx. Calling forth the Pyramid of Knowledge, the Sphinx successfully channels the energies of the duplicate's costones. However, their actions unintentionally created an even bigger menace. The costones have combined themselves into a sentient being who calls itself Ka.
Again, I thank you, Anathene Mutt and Mariette Kareem. Your efforts to protect the time stream have given me life after all of these millennia.
I don't believe it. A costone in humanoid form endowed with intelligence. By the pharaohs, how is such a thing possible?
The Ka-stone somehow manipulated events which allowed it to become sentient. But I don't understand how. It's just an inanimate object. A powerful one, yes, but simply a stone nonetheless.
No, darling. The Ka-stone has always had a voice. Never a strong one but a whisper that has spoken to me since I first donned it.
But I have never heard a voice in all time we have been merged as one being.
Of course not. You have always been a mere shadow of the Ka. A whisper in the sandstorm leeching a meager sliver of the Ka energy to be immortal through reincarnation. You are unworthy of my voice. You should consider the fact that being merged as one being allows you to hear me as a blessing.
Be cautious of your words when you speak of my beloved Ka. You may have been part of my being for thousands of years and your very name means soul in the language of my ancient Egypt, but Mariette Kareem is a part of my soul in ways you will never understand. This will be your only warning.
I appreciate your concern and defense of my honor, my love. However, I am, and have always been, able to take care of myself. What is it that you wish, Ka?
First, I wish the two of you would speak with one voice as you are one body. It's distracting. I am the merging of countless Ka-stones and you hear me talking in one voice. Plus Anath, I prefer not to hear the voice of your female partner. It offends me.
Your sensitivities mean nothing to me, soulless one.
Now that I am no longer tethered to your limited intelligence and contained by your filth-ridden mutated form, which to be honest, I am still trying to wash from my mind, I have chosen to share my essence with the universe. No. The multiverse. No. That is also too limited. I am still adapting to having a physical form, I'm afraid. And deciding on a single personality from all of the people you've absorbed into me over the millennia is distracting. But do not believe you can take advantage of my current state of development, Sphinx. I assure you it would be your final error.
As Ka continues contemplating his existence and purpose, the Sphinx begins inspecting the damaged equipment which was supposed to end the threat to the time stream, but instead brought forth Ka.
Based on the readings of Ka, his energy signature appears to be similar to something I experienced once before. If the structure means what I think it does.
It's obvious you must be dealt with as the two of you as one being is becoming more troublesome the longer you function together. However, I do not know how the effect of destroying you would interfere with my existence and plans. I wonder. Yes, that would be an efficient solution.
My darling.
In a burst of cosmic energy from Ka, the Sphinx is engulfed in a blast of light. When the light dims, the form of the Sphinx is now two, as the Sphinxes had been split into their original male and female forms. The trauma of being split overwhelms both Sphinxes. During their hesitancy, Ka begins his final move.
Now that you are as you should be, I can finally rid myself of a particular annoyance, Lady Sphinx. Blah. The very name burns my tongue, if I had one. Mariette, may I call you Mariette? I was part of the Sphinx for thousands of years. In ways you'll never comprehend. Then you appeared and, in a scarab's breath, take his heart and love. And when you merged with Anath, he could no longer hear me and I was alone. You, a mere human living off the immortality my power provided. However unintentional it may have been. But now you will suffer for your impertinence. Suffer as no human or god has suffered in history.
In a blaze of light, Lady Sphinx's physical form is disintegrated into nothingness. As the light fades, the Sphinx finds himself alone with Ka.
What have you done? You killed her.
No, Aneth. I'm not the monster you seem to think I am. I simply evolved her physical form into one of pure energy. She has been sent a million years into your future without her memory in a world with no humans. There she will be totally alone seeking out someone like you to make her complete again but can never find. And who knows? If she is fortunate to survive her trip through time, the entity she is now may even acquire power from the temporal energies she is experiencing.
You are a monster, Ka. Just because she is gone doesn't mean that I will be yours.
You misunderstand, Sphinx. I no longer think in terms so small like love or companionship or even revenge, which you are no doubt feeling now. Of course you are no threat to me, and my goals are much larger now. You will repair your machinery and continue to feed Ka stones from the Mobius strip into my being. Eventually I will be powerful enough to not only remake your universe, but merge all of the multiverse into my form. I will not only control the remaining universe, I will be the living universe itself and worshipped by all as their true god.
Suddenly, the Pyramid of Knowledge is engulfed in utter darkness and silence. From the blackness, a small circle of light begins to grow into the shape of a cloaked figure and speaks with a voice both calming and frightening at the same time.
A true god, Ka, you will find your ambitions challenged by the god of truth.
Sege, is that truly you? It has been so long since I have seen you, old friend. Where have you been all this time?
Hello, Aneth. Merging with Mariette into one being caused you to become undetectable to me. But the actions of Ka have now made you visible to me again.
Sige, or is it Veritas? I could never keep it straight in all the time you kept appearing to the Sphinx with your creepy voice and even creepier face, or lack thereof. Honestly, how can a human see without a face? Not that I mind. If you had one, I'm sure it would be, shall we say, the ugly truth.
One doesn't need a face in order to face the truth, Ka. And the truth is you are a threat to existence itself and must be destroyed.
The two beings exchange blasts and a display of pure power that rocks the pyramid to its very foundation. The very time stream outside the Sphinx's sanctum begins to bend and twist under the assault upon it by the battle. Ultimately, there can only be one left standing.
Now do you understand, Veritas? Your power of truth is no match for a being who can reshape that very truth with the power to alter reality.
Perhaps. But I don't fight alone. The Sphinx may only have the power of a single Ka stone now, but together we are formidable. And I also brought another warrior to the battle.
From inside Sage's cloak, another light begins to appear and grows into the shape of a red starburst from which a figure bursts forth. The figure streaks across the pyramid and comes to a stop above the combatants with his eyes glowing.
Nova.
Never could get anything past you, Sphinx. Now how about we get down to saving the universe?
Thank you for joining us for the second part of Sands of Time. Look forward to the next installment in a later episode of Xandar Radio.
Final thoughts.
Well, that brings us to the end of this episode of Xandar Radio. I hope you enjoyed it and look forward to receiving your feedback. Send your comments as a voice message and it may be played in a future episode. And of course, you're always welcome to send an email to xandarradio@gmail.com or leave a post at the Xandar Radio Facebook page. All avenues can be reached at novaprimepage.com/podcasts.asp. I'd like to extend a very big thank you to Andrea DeVito for an insightful interview and for his patience and flexibility with rescheduling of the interview due to the unexpected COVID infection. I also want to thank Janko Balash for his participation as narrator in the latest episode of Super Adventures. Thanks, Janko. Great job. Now for the answer to the Nova trivia question. The answer is Mega Man's connection to Rich Rider Nova was Roger Caps Cooper. Mega Man was originally Nathan Cooper, Roger's uncle. After falling through a burning lake, which turned out to be a time vortex, the injured Nathan Cooper was found by a female energy entity 1 million years in the future. Without a full memory of what a human looked like, she did her best and mutated Nathan into the powerful Mega Man. Thank you for taking time to listen to the program today. The next episode of Xandar Radio will be released in April with the latest Nova news, fun features, and a new Studio 64 session. Until then, have a blue blazing day.
This is the World Mind. I am taking back control from my human host. Xandar Radio is a Studio 64 production of the Nova Prime page. This program is the property of Doug Smith. Nova and other characters mentioned are trademarks of Marvel Characters, Incorporated. All rights reserved. Music heard in the program is by Chad Crouch. A link to his site and the license can be found at novaprimepage.com.